This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePaul. This week, we talked to pianist Tony Weinstein about his upcoming recital. We talked to several students about their winter term experiences, including an innovative movement course on campus, an internship with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and an amazing trip to New York City. We continue with The Question You Didn't Ask and introduce a new segment, the 5-Minute iPod. We'll talk to former concerto competition winners and special guest, the Grammy-winning Joseph Schwantner. There are lots of exciting things happening at the DePaul School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. This week we have an exciting faculty recital on Tuesday at 7:30 in Thompson Recital Hall, and it features Tony Weinstein. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your time at DePaul. How long have you been here and exactly what you're doing?
Well, it's my third year here, and I do several different things. My official title is Director of the Accompanying Center, and the biggest piece of what I do here is coaching our student pianists how to accompany. I also teach a little bit of secondary piano, and I do a little bit of accompanying myself, too.
You have a recital coming up this week. Instead of it being a solo recital, it's actually a duo.
Yeah, if anything, it's really my friend Sally Freeland's recital. I'd like to welcome her here.
Welcome, Sally.
Thank you. Hi.
Well, Sally and I have been working together for, 5 years now?
Yeah, coming on 5 years.
And we've done a few recitals together, different programs. This is more or less her lecture recital on the music of Olivier Messiaen. The first half of it will be a lecture about Messiaen, and the second half is a song cycle of his that we'll do together.
Tell us a little bit about Messiaen and how you've come to know him.
Oh, Messiaen is one of my favorite composers from the 20th century. He's a really interesting figure because he sought to use all of his music to evangelize his Christian faith. The Chant de Terre du Ciel, which is the piece we'll be performing, is a great example. The work is all about his family, his first wife, Claire Delbos, and his son, Pascal. And it's about 30 minutes long, 6 songs all about his love of God and family.
It's wonderful to read a biography about a composer, but it's quite another thing to hear them tell their own story in their music.
Well, absolutely, and especially because he wrote his own text for almost all of his vocal works. So we really get a look inside of his head and his heart.
And another way we know this composer is because of the unusual things that he brought to music.
Yes.
Have you looked into that as well?
Absolutely. Well, and the lecture should serve as an introduction to the listener on these aspects of his music and also his poetry. You know, the technical innovations he had, such as the modes of limited transposition, which is probably the most notable hallmark of his music for the different colors it gives it.
And he also did some interesting things. You know, the radio show reaches out into the community and the College of Liberal Arts students and a lot of folks who know a lot about music and some who are just coming to classical music at all. What are some of the interesting things he's done that would really surprise someone who was unfamiliar with his work?
The music will sound very different from classical music that they're listening to, and rhythm. The rhythm is not four square, you can tap your foot to it. He didn't consider music like that to be rhythmic at all, but more things that you would perhaps consider arrhythmic or having no rhythm to a general ear.
And so if you've heard a vocal recital in the past and you come to this, how's it going to be different? What's going to surprise us?
The one thing that surprised me, I have to say, is, again, it's middle of the 20th century music, and it's got a taste and a color of that, really, and it's very distinctively Messiaen. What surprises me about it is how lyrical and how expressive and how colorful the music actually is. Even though it may be non-tonal and the rhythm, as Sally mentioned, is not the easiest thing to tap your foot to, but it is quite expressive and actually fun.
Yes, and you know, composers, I think, always are looking for some way to give the audience a vehicle to follow them. Mm-hmm. You know, if everything is strange, you know, we can't guess anything at all. It's just too hard to follow. While Messiaen's rhythm and use of harmony is very advanced,
the color is so beautiful, mm-hmm. and it's still incredibly lyrical music.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to come in and suspend your disbelief a little bit and then just sit down and let this music take you where it will.
Right.
True.
And this is also a different format than we've had so far in that we have a lecture recital. And lecture recitals are very common, but we haven't done one here for a while. So explain to our listeners exactly what a lecture recital format is like.
A lecture recital hopefully will be really nice for the audience because the first half of the program will be a lecture about not just Messiaen's background, but a thorough background on the piece of music they're about to hear. So it's meant to help prepare the audience for the piece of music we'll perform so that they can enjoy it more and experience it in a deeper way. So half lecture, half recital. Great evening.
These are always fascinating to me. Whenever I'm in a new city and I'm checking out their symphony or whatever, I always try to get into the lecture in advance. You know, oftentimes we have this conversation about the music before the music begins. And as a conductor, I always love to give those lectures before the concert. And they're always fascinating because rather than just come in and be dropped in the middle of the ocean and expect to orient yourself, you get an opportunity first to understand this music and then to hear this music and to make it apply to what you had just heard.
There's a lot to the logic of how the music is put together that is not immediately so easy to pick up, even for a very skilled and trained musician. But once it's explained, you can follow it in the music as you hear it. It becomes much more intelligible and interesting to listen to.
It certainly does. Thank you for bringing it to us in this format, because Messiaen is a little hard to pick up right away. So we're glad we've got this kind of primer before the recital itself so that we can be prepared to appreciate this for the beauty it brings. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The recital is Tuesday night at 7:30 in Thompson Recital Hall, and we hope you'll join us. This is wonderful and unique music, and we'll give you just a little taste of it from a rehearsal. One of the things we're talking about this week on Music for Life is our winter term experiences. Students at DePauw have a wide variety of winter term experiences, both on campus and off. And stopping by the studio now is Dr. Nicole Brockman. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Brockman was on campus this winter term, and she was teaching a class that I heard so much about from so many different students that we've decided to invite a few of your students in to chat with us about the class. Welcome, guys.
I am Kevin Smith. I'm a first-year student here at DePauw, and I'm a saxophone performance track.
My name is Brad Harris. I'm also a freshman here at DePaul University. I'm a saxophone major, and I am a double major with a Bachelor of Musical Arts and a second major in communications.
Dr. Bartman, your class was in Dalcroze. Tell us about it.
Well, this is an approach to music education that was developed by a Swiss composer and theorist active starting at the beginning of the 20th century. And one of the things that he discovered was that students are really able to progress very, very quickly in a lot of very complex musical ideas when they're able to use the body to work out how those ideas play out in music.
And this was radical. I mean, because most of the time we never ever thought of anything like that. It was all what's coming out of the instrument, or you, if you are the instrument in the case of singing. No one ever thought about this before.
Right. What's really interesting is that if you say to anybody in the world that there's a connection between movement and music, they will say, well,
of course
there is, right? No one's going to argue with that. But the idea that you could take this connection, and if you can use the movement in order to study the music, that was really radical. And so this course has really taken that in some interesting directions, which was great.
And you've been doing this for quite a while.
I have.
Yes. And not just at DePaul, but at a lot of different places as well.
Right. I hold the Dalcroze license from Carnegie Mellon University, and I teach there at the summer Dalcroze workshops every summer. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy to have any opportunity I can to bring this work to DePaul. I really think it's something that sets our kind of musical education apart from a lot of other places.
Right, and because it's rare, and it is really life-changing for the people that perform it. So for those who are new to this idea, what would we do? If we come to a Dalcroze class, you know, do we all start chanting and spinning, or?
Well, you could. One of the people that I've worked with closely, Dr. Annabelle Joseph, always says that if you come and observe a Dalcroze class, it looks like a bad dance class, right? So you might at any given time see people walking around the room and clapping or throwing a ball around. What makes Dalcroze different is the way that the student is encouraged to really be in the body, to develop what I call a body feel for how the energy of the movement and the music are progressing. So there's a direct correlation between how our bodies like to move in physical space and how we like to perceive musical energy moving in virtual space. Mm.
And so how has this impacted you guys? So had you ever even heard of Dalcroze before this?
I had not heard of Dalcroze before I came to DePaul, and I had actually had an experience with Dalcroze Eurythmics in my seminar first semester and this past winter term.
How's it impacted your playing?
One of the things that I really enjoyed about the class was there was an afternoon session where we brought in pieces we were working on, and she used this technique to help us explore how to be expressive and how to really improve upon pieces we were working on. For me, it was night and day working through it. Everyone talks about you need to play more expressively or you need to play with more emotion, and it's really hard to teach that. Mm-hmm. But by using this idea of a body feel and using motion to come up with a feel you want, and then using the music to convey that feel to another person, it really made it so much easier to comprehend putting emotion into the music and how to make it expressive.
I think that the music that you create as a musician comes from you. It doesn't come from the instrument. So when we work with Dalcroze, in particular, when we are using movement to solve musical problems, we are developing kind of the abstract, raw musicianship that you have. And then once you have a feeling in the body of what you want to achieve, then it's amazing. The technique takes care of itself. So I do these master classes or clinics for students of every instrument. These two students happen to be saxophone players. But what we find is that there is a remarkable commonality in the musical experience. And once students have gotten into their bodies the way they want the energy to flow, when they pick up the instrument again, the technique just happens magically. I was always amazed to see the amount of progress. A student would play a phrase, and I would say, well, then why don't we walk that phrase? Let's do that in movement.
And as soon as we stepped the rhythm the right way, or the other students in the class really enjoyed what they saw us walk, mm-hmm. we would pick up our instrument, then play those 4 or 5 measures, and everybody in the class had that aha moment, and our music came out.
One of the great things about being a student at DePaul is you get to see your faculty regularly practicing
what they preach. And we were fortunate last semester to have Dr. Brockman present a solo recital where you could tell that she was very much connected physically to the music that was being prepared. So thank you all for coming today, and we're going to hear a little of that as we go away. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
DePauw University School of Music hosts a concerto competition each year. Joining me in the studio are three of last year's concerto competition winners. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we have
Sam Crocker,
Sarah Chamberlain,
Jennifer Wilson.
These folks were three of last year's winners in the concerto competition, and this coming weekend we start the concerto competition process, and these folks have been through it and have won. How was it? How was the experience?
It was wonderful getting to not only work privately with your teacher on the music, but getting to work with Professor Smith and have outside judges come in and examine your music. It's a really good growing experience.
And what's your instrument, Jennifer?
I'm a vocalist.
And so what'd you sing?
I sang Stizzoso Mio Stizzoso from the opera La Serva Padrona by Pergolesi.
Oh, great. How about you?
I definitely agree with Jenny. It's a very unique experience to put together a concerto and work with an orchestra, even if you've been working on it for several months with just your accompanist and your teacher. It's a very different experience from having one accompanist at a piano to having a 60-person orchestra backing you up. Having the opportunity to work with an orchestra is just really fantastic.
Sarah is a flautist.
I am a flautist.
That means she plays the flout.
The flout, of course.
Yeah, I never quite got that anyway. Flutist?
We prefer flutist.
Flutist.
Yes.
Okay, good, good. So she plays the flute. And what did you play?
I played a piece by Johann Stamitz. It was his concerto in G, and he's a kind of late classical composer, so just pre-romantic.
What about you, Sam? How was your experience?
It was awesome. It was kind of weird because I'm used to sitting in the back of the orchestra as a horn player.
Sam's a horn player, right?
Right. And not only have I never gotten to play something with an orchestra, but standing in front like that, it just freaks you out.
Was that your first time of ever auditioning for that?
Yeah, that was my first time auditioning. Yeah.
Wow. So that is a remarkable experience. I mean, most undergraduates don't get that opportunity to play in front of a full orchestra or sing in front of a full orchestra.
It's wonderful.
Was it scary at first?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole process, I'd auditioned before, but every year I get so nervous for this competition, which I shouldn't, but it's definitely nerve-wracking having outside panel come in and evaluate your music. But I like that we have an outside panel. It gives you a chance to really, the teachers give their input, but then you get input from professionals. So it's really, not to say that teachers aren't professionals, but.
Right, right. So in your piece, what was your favorite moment?
Oh, this is hard to say for me. It's just a really beautiful piece all over, just a very pretty, simple, classical piece. And to be honest, I've been fortunate enough to be a multiple winner of the concerto competition, and all my pieces kind of start to blend together after a while. So,
if it works, you don't fix it.
Exactly.
Favorite part of your piece?
Well, my piece is a da capo aria, so it repeats with ornamentation. it goes A, B, A, and I really liked getting to go back into the A section and do some ornamentation. It was very fun, and you get to sort of put your own interpretation, your own spin on the piece, which is really great.
Yeah, da capo aria, we sing the entire thing down as written, and then we get to go back and do the entire thing over again as we want it to.
Exactly.
Yeah, good with a lot of ornamentation. That's great. So Sam, what was your favorite spot?
My piece was kind of an ABA as well, sonata form. So when the main material from the beginning comes back the second time, it kind of picks up, and right before our cadenza at the end, there's this huge fast section with tons of notes. That was really fun to play.
That's
yeah, that was
great.
My favorite. Glad you guys could join us, and good luck this year.
Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Last week, we started a new segment called The Question You Never Asked, and it's our effort to help demystify classical music. We hope that you'll provide these questions as well by emailing us at musicforlife@depauw.edu. Joining me for this segment is another of our staff members. This is Phil Pasqua. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
What's our question this week?
This week's question is, what is the concert venue's effect on concert etiquette and the overall concert experience?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question because it's so different in the classical world than it is from the pop world, right?
Yeah, most definitely.
Most of the time, you know, what we're used to is we come to a concert and we cheer and we clap along, we dance in the aisles, we do all that. Do we do that in Kresge?
No, we don't do that so much. There's more so one-way type of communication, one stream of communication. So it goes from performer to listener, and that's what Kresge Hall and a lot of concert halls in the United States and the world do. They facilitate that one-way
communication. Right, that's a very important point. It's not that we're not participating. We're absorbing, you know, as the listener. We're
exactly.
Still there. It's just that we are not cheering and clapping or singing along as we might in another venue. That's probably a little off-putting to some College of Liberal Arts students or public who've not been there before.
Yeah, most definitely, especially for people who haven't been to concerts. I mean, the whole setup of an auditorium or a concert hall is very isolating, and it can alienate people because it makes the person sit in their chair. The chairs are bolted to the ground. Sometimes you can't leave the audience and just really focus on the music at hand and the performer and the performance.
And so why is it different? Why do we do it that way?
I think it has to do probably with active and passive listening. You know, that's what concert halls are set up to do.
An excellent point. You know, the idea of passive listening. We're all great listeners of music. I mean, everybody listens to music, but it's always passively. It's playing in the background while we're doing something
else.
Exactly. And this really forces you to be an active listener.
Yeah, I mean, I catch myself all the time. I'm listening to classic music, but I'm also doing homework. It's usually just always in the background. I'm never really active listening.
And that's a real challenge, to sit and listen actively. And the concert hall is designed to remove all those distractions so that you truly can focus on this music, which is really quite a challenge. It's interesting, you mention it as a one-way communication from the performers on the stage to the people in the audience, whereas in a rock and roll concert, it's probably more two-way. The performers are expecting a big response from the audience, and they might sing along or clap. As a member of the Dean's Advisory Council in the School of Music, we've actually talked about this idea of a Twitter concert or a Facebook concert. So how exactly would that work?
Well, it creates, I think, more of a two-way environment for communication. It's a little more intimate, less formal, and it's more inviting for people who aren't really quite acquainted with the whole classical music scene.
Right. The idea would be you could come in with your phone or your computer, log on to a website, and then as the music was being performed, you could comment. And the comments would be read on the screen over the heads of the performers. And even the performers, if they weren't actually playing or singing at that particular moment, could comment as well. It'd be a wild experiment. I've never seen it done, but it could be kind of interesting.
Yeah, most definitely. It would release a lot of pressure from the performance aspect and also from the audience. There'd be a lot. It would just be more relaxed in general.
So what would you tell the community or the College of Liberal Arts student who's never been to Kresge and they're on their way in? What would you tell them?
Just, you know, have an open mind and really focus on the music that at hand, because that's what Kresge's ultimate purpose is, to, you know, facilitate active listening, which is just missing in our lives.
Right. Yeah. Leave your worries at the door. Come in and actively engage in this music and see what
exactly
happens.
Exactly.
Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was great being here.
One of the exciting things about DePauw is the winter term experience. It's an opportunity between the fall semester and the spring semester to do a special project. Some folks go off campus, some folks go abroad, some folks stay and take special courses. And we've been talking about different folks' winter term experiences. So we have two guests with us today.
Orlando Ramirez.
Lizzie Wade.
These folks shared a common experience because you guys were interns with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, correct?
Yes.
That's right.
What a remarkable opportunity. Now, had you ever done this before?
No, this is my first time.
Yeah, this is my first time as well.
So that's got to be kind of frightening to walk into one of the world's major orchestras and suddenly go to work, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
I work for two departments. I work for their learning community as well as the artistic planning department.
And what did you do?
I was under the executive office, but I actually got to work with the marketing department and also with development mostly.
How'd you guys get this gig?
I just had this idea in mind for a long time, and then I went to talk to Professor Smith, and he happens to know the contact with Laura, who's my boss, and she was a DePauw grad. And she works under the learning community, and that's how I got the contact.
And Lizzie was so good at the job, they kept you on. It even extended beyond winter term,
yes.
Right? Wow. Now, how about you? How did you get into this gig, Orlando?
I actually tracked down Simon Krukel, who was the CEO and president of the ISO, during the DePauw discourse. And I introduced myself.
Yeah, you see, DePauw students are always such shy, retiring types. Yeah, way to go. That's the way to get to it.
Yeah, and so I kept in contact with him, and eventually, I told him about the winter term experience, and I asked if I could either go or have the opportunity to just watch. But he then, in turn, took it and said, well, why not intern? It was pleasant to
So are you finished now, or did you wrap it up?
I did wrap it up. However, I am told them if they need anything, I'm willing to help out.
So tell me what kinds of things you were doing. Lizzie, what were you up to?
For winter term for the learning community, I wrote their student newsletters, the cutout for the coffee concert. They call it a score, and I did all the research, and I put on the research program for that. And I did the pre-concert activities research for the Words on Music. So I did a lot of research for the learning community, and I helped out for their side-by-side program. I check in students and guide them to whatever they need to be. For the artistic administration part, I was the guest artist liaison, which I love.
Ooh, so did about you get to work with some cool people?
Yeah. Yes, I met all those great artists, you know, like to name a few. Yathin Bronfman and Katya Bunyatishvili at Long Long.
Wow.
Too. So, yeah. It was a great experience just to see how those people were committed to their work and how much they actually really practiced behind the scene.
Wow.
It was amazing.
That's terrific. How about you?
With the marketing department, I helped out the digital media director, and the concerts that get promoted online are put up by an outside vendor, Instant Encore. And so basically I was just uploading all the concerts onto Instant Encore so that you can get it on your iPhone app and the Droid apps. And
yeah, it's great to have it as an app. I love those Instant Encore apps. Those are so cool.
I know. And that was actually really eye-opening just to see just the little details that go into something like that, just so that you can press the button on your phone and you get all that information.
Yeah, for us it's so simple. We pick up our phone, we push this button and it plays, and we don't realize all of the work that went into that to make that happen.
Yeah.
You know, this is a remarkable thing. I mean, we're talking about undergraduates. We're talking about people still in college getting these great opportunities to do things that, you know, that app is used around the world. People who follow the Indianapolis Orchestra, that's phenomenal. And for you to get to work with Long, oh my gosh.
Just following.
Yeah, you know, you'd almost have to pinch yourself and say, am I really doing this?
Yeah, sometimes it's like, wow.
Yeah, what a great
this
opportunity.
Real life.
Well, we're very fortunate to have the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra just right down the road. And, and of course, they're coming to DePauw to perform, as you well know, because you guys were working there. You were working both ends of that story because we're having them come to DePauw to perform The Planets and the Barber Adagio on March 17th.
That's right.
And the Concertmaster is playing a concerto.
Yes, right. Zach is playing a concerto. And if you've never heard the Adagio for Strings, what an amazing piece of music. One of the most beautiful pieces of music ever written. And for those people in my generation, it's often remembered because it was the soundtrack to Platoon.
Oh, wow.
And it was an interesting directorial choice to take the horrors of Vietnam. And against what your eyes were seeing, you heard the most beautiful, peaceful music in the world, this Barber Adagio, and a powerful impact on folks of my generation. So, in fact, we'll take this one out with a performance of the Barber Adagio for Strings. And thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
So this week we have a new segment that will return each week. This is called the 5-Minute iPod. And the idea is that if your only source of music could be an iPod that only held 5 minutes of music, what would it be? Now, no one's ever going to be able to pull this off and limit it to 5 minutes, but we'll see what happens. And our first contestant on the 5-Minute iPod is Dr. Kerry Jennings. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jennings is on our vocal faculty here, and so you've got it. Here's your iPod. It's got just a few minutes on it. What's on it?
My knee-jerk reaction when asked this question is the 1972 recording of La Boheme conducted by Von Karajan with Mirella Ferraini and Luciano Pavarotti, which I think is the quintessential recording of La Boheme.
Why
I think
is that?
A lot of people would agree. Well, we have a fantastic conductor to start with. We have one of the greatest opera composers of all time, and we have probably the two best interpreters of those major roles.
And I tend to agree with you on all counts.
There. They were in their prime as well. I mean, they were both 37 at the time that they recorded this, and it's just amazing singing all the way around.
And it's one of the world's most loved operas.
Most loved operas. It's a little cliche for me to say that that's my favorite opera, but I just can't help it.
Well, I can't help it either. So if there's something wrong with it, I don't care. I'm saying it anyway. But your iPod's only got 5 minutes, so you got to dial it down.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to go with then the end of Che Gelida Manina, leading into the beginning of Si Mi Chiamano Mimi. If I could have that whole section, if I could stretch it out somehow and have the two arias, then the duet that follows, then my life would be pretty complete.
Okay.
But I guess if I could get a little bit of both of them, I'd go for it.
That's what we'll do then. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So this week we're talking to folks about their winter term experiences. And joining me in the studio are Dr. Lansrein and Dr. Edberg, who led a great winter term experience to New York City. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you've brought some folks with you here as well.
Hi, I'm Brooke Addison.
I'm Colin Hutchison.
Hi, I'm Mary Malter.
And so tell us a little bit about what your goal with the trip was.
Well, the trip was called Traditional and Genre Busting Music in New York City. And the goal was to have as much exposure as possible to as many ways of presenting classical music and kind of post-classical, alternative classical music as possible. So we worked really hard, Dr. Lansrein and I, to create an itinerary where we'd go to all the really big famous places like Carnegie Hall and Avery Fisher Hall and the Metropolitan Opera, and also go to the kind of the other end of the spectrum. So we went to Le Poisson Rouge, which is a nightclub in Greenwich Village that presents classical music, among other things. We went to the Issue Project Room, which is a new music experimental performance art space in Brooklyn. We went to the Cornelius Street Cafe, that is a restaurant that also presents all sorts of music, and where we went to an opera open mic night. And we went to this little hole-in-the-wall storefront place called The Stone. And then we listened to some as far out as you can get music is possible, which actually gave one of the students a migraine.
So how many folks did you take?
We were a very small group, which actually only four students all together.
Oh, great.
Which gave us lots of flexibility to sometimes even split the group and go to events. It also gave us the opportunity to sneak into places where you with a big group couldn't get in, like for example the pit of the Metropolitan Opera, where the concertmaster David Chen took us on our visit when we went to the Met for the first time to listen to a rehearsal with René Fleming.
And so one of the great things about DePauw is that we can take these small, you know, we have these small classes and winter term all together. So two professors and four students make their way to New York City. Sounds like the beginning of a sitcom, maybe. Or maybe it was a bit of a sitcom. I don't know. How did you guys like it?
A little bit.
So what was your favorite part?
All the music, but especially opera. I kind of grew up not liking opera, and then I went to the opera, I guess with an open mind this time, and I really liked the two operas we saw, Faust and Tosca, at the Met.
What was your favorite part?
Oh my goodness, I can't ever answer with one thing. There's so many different places that we went to. I loved the opera as well, and then Professor Edberg and I and Catherine Drew went and saw How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which was a wonderful show, and René Fleming was just spectacular.
And you got to meet René Fleming.
We ran into her in the hall, actually, when David Chen was giving us the tour, and this woman was walking down the hallway, and he goes, "Oh, hey, René," and just gives her a hug really casually, and then she walked up and spoke to us. It was fantastic.
And what was your favorite?
Oh, anything involving René Fleming, the master class, the concert, the rehearsal, meeting her in the hallway. She's such an amazing person.
All right. How many days were you there?
We were there 10 days altogether.
Wow. So you had an action-packed agenda for all 10 of those
We did,
days.
And actually, I think we were there 12 nights.
Oh.
It was so many days, we didn't even know how long we were there.
And I just counted it up. We had 37 events in those 12 days that we were in New York City.
37 events in
12
days.
37 events, depending on you count. Like, yeah. For instance, one morning we went to Avery Fisher Hall and were met at the stage door by Carter Bray, who's the principal
right.
cellist, who gave us a backstage tour and a tour of all the offices. And then he put us in the orchestra box, where all the big shots get put usually, and we listened to a working rehearsal, the New York Philharmonic. And then we had a little break, and then we met with Julie Oh, who's the director of marketing for the New York Philharmonic, and we were especially interested in how the Philharmonic is reaching out to audiences under 40, and also Ted Weiprud, who's the education director for the Philharmonic.
How has your view of music changed?
For me, again, the biggest thing was I discovered that I like opera, and it was a really great experience, and I look forward, since I live in New Jersey, to going to the Met Opera more often now.
So let me get that straight. You live in New Jersey, you come to school in Indiana so that you could go to the opera in New York.
Yeah.
We got it covered. All right.
It's funny how things work.
How about you?
For me, I learned the importance of marketing and networking just through the experiences we got to go see with David Chen, through Professor Lansrein, and all the things that we got to do with that.
Yeah, it's
relationships are really important in music.
Yeah, it's amazing how much of this trip was put together just because your two professors happen to know so many people and they have these ins and these connections that can get you here and there. And
we also had this wonderful opportunity, speaking of DePauw connections, James Stewart, who's a board member and mm-hmm. this year's commencement speaker and a Pulitzer Prize winning author, is a business columnist at the New York Times.
Among him, when he's not busy winning Pulitzer Prizes, exactly, he writes an article
exactly,
every now and
exactly.
then.
Exactly. And so when I told him about the trip when he was here for the Yo-Yo Ma DePauw Discourse events, he said, oh, well, I'm friends with John Landsman, who is the culture editor. So he put us in touch with each other, and then John invited us to meet with him. And then when we got there, not only was John there, but also Jim Astrike, who is the music editor of the New York Times, and Alan Kazin, who is one of the music critics. And we had a fascinating conversation with them. And then we were able to go with John to the Page One meeting at the New York Times, where all the editors sit around a big conference table and decide what's going to be on the front page of the next
day. Of the most
New
powerful newspaper in America.
That's right.
And you were sitting there watching it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, this is so remarkable. It sums up what is the DePauw experience. You know, here we have an alumni and a very successful personality in New York and James B. Stewart, who has been here because his last book was turned into an opera, and he presents that to us, and then he helps you guys while you're down there. That gets you into the New York Times. You get the opportunity to get into the Met. You know what? I can't think of a place that does that as well as DePauw does. Thank you guys for all joining us.
Thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You.
Thank you.
Trying to pick one track of Renee Fleming's amazing discography is an impossible task, but this is a beautiful moment from the Andre Previn opera, A Streetcar Named Desire, in which she plays Blanche, and this is the beautiful aria, Soft People Have Got to Shimmer and Glow. Next guest is the man of the hour. We are thrilled to be here with Dr. Joseph Schwanner. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be on campus.
We're thrilled to have you here. This has been an exciting week for us. There's so many great things going on. And on Wednesday for the recital hour, we had the opportunity to hear a bit of the first percussion concerto and also then have Dr. Schwanner talk to us a little bit about that. And we had a grand time. You were really good at that.
You know, I'm an old professor.
Yes, that's true. We caught on to that very quickly.
Have a lot to say.
Well, usually, you know, it's not uncommon to have a composer that you can't get
to speak about their work, yeah. you know, and you were so illuminating about what was going on.
Well, let me tell you, this is really a wonderful campus. I've been embraced in the most generous way, I have to tell you. And the performances that I've heard thus far in rehearsal have been spectacular. It's a really incredible institution. The performance I heard this morning of Soaring for flute and piano, this very short little, almost 2-minute piece, I had nothing to say. It was so good. It was that. Wow. It was spellbindingly good.
Oh,
I mean, wait till you hear them play in concert. It's really quite remarkable. It's an amazing institution for a liberal arts college to have such a distinguished school of music. There's just no question about it. And the level of playing has simply been superlative. So wow. I can't. I have only positive reaction. The other thing that I have to say that has never happened to me before and makes me even more grateful to be here was is how ambitious the program has been in terms of engaging a composer's work that span over 35 years. I mean, it's really been remarkable. And I've done similar kinds of things in past at other institutions, but none of them have kind of jumped off the deep end and decided to engage so much of my music, and that's been really quite remarkable. And for that, I'm grateful to you and to all of the fine students and faculty here.
Oh, the pleasure has been all ours. People have been raving about you all week. And, you know, last week you were the focus of our show, and people have been talking about your music for quite some time. But this week, it's not the music. It's about actually getting to meet Dr. Schwantner and getting to find out about the music and how it's written. I mean, you've really lit a fire on campus,
oh, good.
And we certainly appreciate it.
I hope so. I've been writing music for a long time, and I still come to it in a kind of childlike fashion when I think about my own work, even today at the age of 69. And I think that's really important for any artist to feel like the next day has new, unexplored opportunities to engage one's work in a serious way. And so that idea hasn't changed since I was a very young man.
That's great.
Young boy, actually, composing music.
Right, the blank page, the excitement of the blank page.
Oh, for sure. Well, it can be terrifying as well because sometimes the page remains blank for far too long, but somehow you find a way to find that double bar.
I have a terrible confession to make that actually I was a composer as well. And
oh, really?
I'm scared to death that one day you'll hear my first symphony and recognize it all too well.
Well, I actually look forward to it. Tell me about it.
But this has been really exciting for us. And I want to know, I have a question I do want to ask you about. So it wasn't enough to be a Pulitzer Prize winning composer. On Sunday night, you won a Grammy. Now that's pretty impressive. Your work won a Grammy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's in the hands of the gods, I guess, the Grammy gods. certainly all credit goes to the solo performer, Christopher Lamb, who actually received the Grammy for Best Solo Performance in a work, in a recording. And I have to say the members of the Nashville Symphony were just stellar in their engagement with Christopher in just a kind of jaw-dropping performance of the music when I was there and the recording that came out of that, you know. And those are very special times when things... Well, the stars align in a very special way with this actually extraordinary orchestra. Nashville is playing better than
they really are.
I've ever heard them play. And to have then the person that I wrote the piece for to come back after some 17 years when he first premiered it with the New York Philharmonic has been a real joy for me. Because he also comes back as a middle-aged man, but yet playing like he was 18.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it absolutely is true. And I, of course, recalled when he was a student at the Eastman School of Music and a young kind of hotshot undergraduate, that kind of engagement in music has not changed. So even though he's a bit gray around the temples, the musical playing is as though he were still a young, energetic fellow.
You know, we talked about that a few weeks ago on our show, about the wisdom that comes with age.
Yeah.
You know, we hear all these great wunderkinds and the young kids that look like they're not old enough to have a driver's license,
right,
but they've got their picture on the cover. But there's something different about having played a piece for a while and it seasoning with you over time.
I mean, it's a kind of pride of ownership that, you know, the piece was written for him, written by a composer who I think understood what he was capable of, to give him an opportunity to display his prodigious musical talents, and then to have the opportunity to come back later after thinking about the piece for many years and to re-engage it and bring new life to it and new perspectives. And, you know, that's what all great music does.
Right.
Not my music
right.
necessarily, but great music.
will draw you back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, how can you possibly come back to yet another performance of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony?
Right.
If a conductor doesn't bring a new vision to the music in a way, or an orchestra or an ensemble in a way that you hadn't maybe thought about in other experiences with that work,
right.
As familiar as it might be. And important music does do that and gives us the opportunity to re-engage it with new vision, with new ideas, and new levels of understanding of how the music should go. And then draw in the audience, hopefully, for those right. great experiences.
And, you know, we've been talking this week about the fact that some composers, you know, are shy, reclusive types, and they're great. We love their music, but they're hard to engage.
Yeah.
And students are talking about how exciting it is to engage with you. And you and I have both chatted about your professorial background. But actually, it's kind of interesting for you because you do have your former students come back. Pamela Coburn, who is on our faculty here and an opera star in her own right, is singing one of your pieces.
Right.
And you knew her when she was a student.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there are a lot of Eastman School of Music alumni around, and a few at this institution
yes,
as well,
indeed.
I understand.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
It's hard to get away from them, actually.
Try as you might. Yeah. So it's been great to have you here this week.
You.
And is there anything in particular that's been a highlight or a work that you can't wait to hear played? Or?
Well, I just have to say of how committed the students seem to be, and seriously they're taking this music, very challenging music that they certainly haven't performed before. And their ability to put it together in the time that they have with everyone's busy schedules has been admirable. And I'm really grateful for the school, for the invitation, and really the opportunity at the end of the day to work with the students, because that's the most exciting part of it all, and that's why we're all here.
Right.
You know? And we hope we leave them with some sense of understanding the nature of the work and their engagement with it and how they can grow as musicians as a result of performing my music.
Right, and having the opportunity to work with the composer on their work. That's a rare treasure, and especially
Brahms does not seem to answer his emails.
I have noticed that. I think he's got a problem. Well, it has been our pleasure to have you on campus, and we hope that you'll come back soon.
Many thanks.
It's our pleasure. Well, that wraps up our show this week, and we're glad you could join us at Music for Life, Music from DePaul. Our student producers are Sam Crocker, Adam Luman, Anna Gadula, and Phil Pasqua. Our show is produced and engineered by Matthew Champagne and recorded live in Studio B of the Green Center for the Performing Arts. I'm Mark McCoy. I'm the executive producer of Music for Life and dean of the School of Music. And we're glad you could join us this week. Hope you will join us next week at 6 p.m. on WGRE. But more importantly, we hope to see you in the Green Center this week for the exciting performances coming up. And we'll wrap up this week's show with a recording from the performance of Thursday Night as part of our Music of the 21st Century. This is Joseph Schwantner's haunting Veiled Autumn, performed by Elisa Helsmer.